I decided I wanted to sell candy and sodas in front of his real estate. My stand was so successful, he's like, hey, this would be a good location for a store. So on it, it was called S&J Market. My dad's name is Stan.
So Stan and Jamal.
In high school, I was a barber. Take my clippers to school and cut in the locker room sometimes. I put stairs in people's heads. In hindsight, I should have been charging much more than
that. I'm a college dropout. Why did you stop the college?
Truthfully, because I didn't see a path for the success in the areas I wanted to be successful in. When I got into high school, I really got heavy into music. I was always into the production end as well, from house to electronica to hip hop to R&B to basically an electronic group. I've been all over China. I've been to Japan playing music, and I got paid for it as well. Produced music for a documentary that was narrated by Chuck D. It was called Third and Long. It was about the integration of pro football, and it aired on CBS. I was a bartender. Still bartend one night a week. And he kept telling me, he was like, you of all people, Jamal, need to be in New York. As soon as I touched down in Manhattan, I knew immediately. I was like, yeah, I have to live here. Get here, and it's hard. You know, it's expensive. It stinks in the summertime. And only the people who are real hustlers who really want to do something in this city stay here. Experience a lot of people pack up and leave after 6 months. Creative mind, where if there's something I'm into, I'll go down that road to try to figure out how it's done. Basically every country I've ever been to, there's always some amazing market that the locals go to. Mexico, definitely an inspiration with the street food. You have salty cheese and sweet caramel in this sweet waffle cone. Just made my brain go, I've been to Argentina. People who are running these businesses everywhere I've gone, these outdoor businesses, they are all super happy. Real freedom. When you work for yourself, you are in charge. Grew up with a family who had a small business. I know how much work it is. My wheels started to turn for several years. I was like, you know, one of these days, I think I want to do something like that. And New York has this vibrant outdoor vendor scene, whether it's Smorgasbord that we spoke of, or just the weekly street. The hot sauce business, I didn't start as a hot sauce company. Pepper, salt, paprika are three of the main components when you're cooking Southern food. My family's from the South. So I grew up with, you know, with really authentic Southern flavors. And when I started my business, I started a Southern food business. Well, my catfish po' boys, I took basically the credit cards that I had and I maxed them out. My father lent me $2,500, which I just paid him back. I ultimately settled on a fried okra po' boy and a fried catfish po' boy. I don't want my sandwich to taste like everyone else's sandwich.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm gonna make my own hot sauce. I don't believe in luck. I believe in preparation and effort. I went on a mission to make good hot sauce. Cayenne's really difficult to get in New York fresh.
I literally tried it. I'm like, I gotta get this guy on my show.
I took his advice, and what I did was I made the sauce a soft sell, and I bottled it with a generic label. I didn't even have names for them. My first week of business, the food does okay. My signage is terrible. Something amazing happened. I sold out of sauce. People who wanted to try the food, they came and bought the food. People who saw the hot sauce came and wanted to try the hot sauce. Yes. Food was backbreaking, by the way. And I made a small profit the second week. Gonna see what happens if I just sell sauce this week.
What was the moment where you're like, I'm dropping food?
At about 3 o'clock that day, I was like, I'm a hot sauce business. That comes the development of the e-commerce business. So come, they buy the sauce, they have to go back to their country, their state. And now they're in love with the sauce. So they wanna get some more. They come to my website and they buy it. The repeat business has been outstanding. Couple customers who have ordered 6 and 7 times from me. Every one of the models I've sold, I made them with my own hands, having to not participate in certain events because I can't keep up with the production. I enjoy getting out and talking to people. So the more time I'm making sauce or overseeing the making of sauce, the less time I get to be out there with the people. You will go through several co-packers. My dad, who's a retired accountant, is my accountant. These are in order of spice level. I have my everything green. That's a jalapeno sauce. I've got my Indonesian cayenne, which is obviously a cayenne sauce. It's like if a cayenne and a Szechuan had a baby.
Oh.
So you get like that classic cayenne flavor. I add a little more ginger to that with a nice Szechuan-like tingle on the back end.
Ah.
Got my sweet Thai chili, which basically, my travels to Asia, I took the flavors of Southeast Asia and I converted them into a Louisiana style hot sauce.
We're talking Southern Asian fusion.
Yes. Whether you're dealing with sounds, colors, or flavors, they're all frequencies. So when you balance those frequencies, then you have something that is viable that other people will be able to appreciate. Everyone has good ideas. There's not a single person that you've met that has not had a good idea. Most people are afraid of taking that chance. They're afraid of judgment. They're afraid of failure. Failure is just another lesson.
In what ways do you think you have grown as an entrepreneur?
I've grown in my discipline. I've become a much more disciplined person. This is the hardest I've ever worked in my life, but it's the most satisfying thing I've ever done. Go to PSPBrooklyn.com so you can order online or you can come buy it in person. You know, whatever works for you.
I want to tell you to go order this. I have given it my seal of approval. So this is good stuff. And you should try it. So thank you so much for coming on, Jamal.
Hey, thanks for having me, Hunter. It was a pleasure, man. I really enjoyed it.
Yes.
Thank you, brother.
Welcome to Startup Hunter, also streaming on YouTube. I am here with Jamal Richardson of PSP, which...
Hello, Startup Hunters. Thank you guys so much for listening. This podcast would be nothing without you. And also, this podcast is a startup, so I need all the help that I can get. Would you please leave me a good review in the App Store? This would be huge. That's it. On to the episode.
Look at that. The bottle has been popped.
Pepper, salt, paprika.
Look at that. We had the chorus. It's done. So I tried Jamal's sauce at this street fair because he's out here in New York City hustling. I instantly knew he had a winner.
Thank you.
Like, if you don't taste this stuff, you're not gonna understand what I'm talking about. But he's really made a good sauce here. The question is, how do we make it into a real serious business? Now, the format of this show, I know you've taken a look at it.
Absolutely.
Is I want to go all the way back to the past.
Sure.
What I want to know is, where were you born, Jamal, and what did your parents do? I see you're repping a Brooklyn shirt, mm-hmm. So that might give us a little hint.
I am repping a Brooklyn shirt, but I am not originally from Brooklyn. I was originally born in Oakland. I was born and raised in Oakland, California, but I've been in Brooklyn for 15 years. So I felt like, you know what, I've been here long enough to rep a Brooklyn shirt. I feel like it's safe to get away with that at this point.
So you were born in Oakland. What did your folks do?
My dad was an accountant, and my mom was a patient activity director. I believe that was her title.
Did either of them run their own business?
Yes. When I was a kid, my dad, I believe he's retired now, but he still has his broker's license. So he messed around in real estate quite a bit. Not in big, huge commercial ventures, but he owned some rental property, and also he was into buying property and fixing it up, fixer-uppers, if you will, renovating them and then selling them.
Did he run his accounting business?
He worked for the city as an accountant.
Okay, so he was an employee there.
Uh-huh.
But he did have a side hustle with real estate.
Yeah, real estate and...
Any of that Oakland Hill action.
Exactly. And we also owned a small store when I was a kid, too.
What did the store do?
It was a little grocery store.
So what
so
I want
to bodega, as they call it in New York.
What I want to know, did any of this entrepreneurship rub off on you? You know, working in your folks' store or seeing your dad do a real estate. Do you feel like any of that rubbed off on you?
You know, it's funny. You could actually say it probably went both ways, because the store, my father had the real estate. He always had a real estate office when I was younger. And at some point I decided I wanted to sell candy and sodas in front of his real estate
now
office.
We're talking. So
right,
he'd kick anyone else out off the street. Watch out for the poop.
Yep.
He'd kick anybody else out except you.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
he let you set up your little rogue storefront.
Yep.
And how old were you?
I was 8.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah. I may have been 7. I was either 7 or 8. I think I was 8.
Yeah.
The stand did really well. The funny thing, it was my idea, but my dad got super excited about it, so the variety of candy definitely increased. I was thinking about having 3 or 4 things. We ended up with 25 or 30 items out there.
Oh, so you're like as much variety as the bodega.
So that actually leads into the bodega. The candy stand did so well, like I made so much money that where my dad's real estate office was, he had a second tenant. There were 2 units there. He had the small side, which was his real estate office, and there was a small beauty shop there where they did hair and that type of, a salon, if you will. And the salon was moving, and he basically had a vacancy coming up, and he decided he was gonna join the units and open up a store there because of basically the R&D that I had done, basically, because you know, my stand was so successful. He's like, hey, this would be a good location for a store.
You proved that there is demand.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then
I
goes,
was the test kitchen.
He goes and he takes it to another level.
Yes.
So you basically, you're the founder of that bodega.
Yes. And actually, my name was on it. It was called S&J Market.
So you're...
My dad's name is Stan.
So Stan and Jamal.
Stan and Jamal. Yep.
Is that business still operating today?
It is not operating today. We had the business for several years, and then we transferred it over to one of my uncles. My parents still worked full-time jobs the entire time. The business was very profitable, but at a point, it just was taking too much toll. It was a little too much work for them, and we weren't able to get a beer and wine license there.
Oh, so that's huge.
Yeah, huge. If we had been able to get a beer and wine license, they may have quit their city jobs, honestly. The store was very successful.
Yeah.
But not being able to sell, you know, beer and wine in a store, your profit margins are just really small, and they had good city jobs with retirement plans and stuff like that, so they weren't willing to quit those. So they ultimately sold the business to my uncle, who probably kept that store open for another 10 years before he ultimately sold it. Yeah, so it was definitely a successful business. I believe there is still a business in that location today.
So moving forward, what was the next hustle that you had, maybe a little older?
In high school, I was a barber.
A barber?
Yeah, so I would cut friends' hair.
In Oakland?
Yeah.
I probably went to that shop.
Oh, I didn't work in a shop. I basically cut out of my kitchen, and I would take my clippers to school and cut in the locker room sometimes.
Oh, so you were like just a down low on the QT barber.
Absolutely. I was cheaper than the shops and arguably as good as some of them because, you know, I was always a decent artist, so I was willing to take chances, and people were willing to let me take chances with their head. So I would, you know, this is in the early 80s, I'm not that old. This is in the late 80s.
So do you do any kid and play haircuts?
Absolutely. I put stairs in people's heads. Some of you guys might know of a couple of people whose hair whose heads I've cut over the years. I cut Casuals from Hieroglyphics hair a few times when he was younger. I actually cut stairs in his high top, and a few other Oakland celebrities. I
also MC Hammer?
I did not do MC Hammer's head. Unfortunately, he was...
He was beyond your price point.
Exactly. Exactly. But people would trust... I would put different designs and stuff in people's heads and stuff, in addition to giving them a decent cut as well.
So this was high school?
This was in high school.
Uh-huh. I'm sure you
junior
got some,
high school.
Some side change from that. Really great. I love the hustle because that's not common. You don't really hear guys in high school cutting people's hairs.
Right.
Hair in the hallways.
Totally. Locker room.
I love it.
I didn't charge enough, honestly.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I should have been charging much more than I
was. Because you had a really unique service. Nobody was really competing with you.
Exactly.
And who knows, though, if you did charge more, maybe you would have had some competition because somebody would have said, like, oh, who's this guy charging $200 a haircut?
You're right.
And
my future wasn't as a barber anyway.
So,
it was fun. It was fun.
So did you go to college?
I did not. Mm-mm. Well, I did some JC. I did a couple years of JC.
And then why'd you... No, but I'm a college dropout. Why did you stop the college?
Truthfully, because I didn't see a path for the success in the areas I wanted to be successful in being offered.
Now, what did you want? What areas were interesting to you?
At the time, when I got into high school, I really got heavy into music, and I wanted to be a hip hop artist, straight up. So I got into production, I got into writing. Well, I was doing it before then. I was doing it really from age 9 on. It was always kind of in my back pocket as a hobby. But by the time I got to high school, I started meeting people who were serious about it. So I immediately jumped into that. And once I got into high school and started meeting people that had the same interests, I started taking it a lot more seriously.
And then hip-hop?
Yes. Amongst other types of music too. I was always into the production end as well. So when it came to production, I would do just about anything from house to electronica to hip-hop to R&B to basically any type of music.
Now, what kind of gear were you producing on 808s?
My first piece of gear that I owned for myself was an SP-1200, which is the classic sampler drum machine of the day. And I think I got my first, I bought that in 1993? Yeah, 92 maybe is when I got my first one, right when I got out of high school. That's when I got my first piece of equipment.
And So how, like, where did that go? And watch out for the poop.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, man, it was great for me. I ended up having I don't want to say a career in music, but I did tour with a band. We got to go, well, with an electronic group. I've been all over China. I've been to Japan playing music. I've been to Malaysia playing music. I've been to many places in the States playing music. And I got paid for it as well. I was lucky enough to produce music for a documentary that was narrated by Chuck D. Some of you may have heard of that guy before. The documentary was called Third and Long. It was about the integration of pro football. And it aired on CBS. So I had some success in the music industry. I can't complain.
Well, no, you're dealing with major, you know, productions. How long were you, now it sounds like you're building up to maybe you didn't make it in the music industry, but maybe you did make it. So how long was your music career?
I still mess around a little bit, but as far as me stepping away from it and saying, all right, you know what, this is no longer what I want to make a living at, I'd say there was a 10-year window of me actually making money doing it.
Yeah, so it was part of the mix. How else were you supplementing your income, you know, during that time?
Take a wild guess. What do most musicians, you know, probably do?
Be a waiter.
I was a bartender.
See, I have always wanted to be a bartender. Uh-huh. And the opportunity has just never presented itself to me.
You'd be good at it because you like talking to people.
Exactly.
And you're comfortable with strangers.
That's why I want to be a bartender. So just be like a therapist. You know, I want to be like, anyway, that's not happening anytime soon.
Right.
So you were a bartender.
Uh-huh.
Now in Oakland.
In San Francisco, mainly. And in New York, as long as I've been here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been in Brooklyn 15 years. I still bartend one night a week.
Let's talk about and lots of people building businesses.
Yeah.
And people that have been on this show have side hustle. Let's talk about moving from California to New York.
Sure.
When did that happen?
15 years ago. So I have a really good friend of mine. It's really my best friend. I'm the godfather of his son. And about 15 years ago, we were in a music group together. It was called Unconscious Logic. You could still find some of our music out there on YouTube, etc. And he had decided, hey man, I want to live in New York. He had come out here a few times and he was basically sold on it. He's like, I'm going to New York. And he was coming out here for a job interview. He had already started setting up interviews and he had decided he was coming out here.
And what kind of job?
You know what, I don't remember he was doing whatever would get him here.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't anything amazing, but it was something so he could get his feet on the ground running. He was coming out here for a 4th of July weekend.
It's literally like tomorrow.
Yeah, so
2 days from now.
Yeah, so it's actually the anniversary for my first visit out here today.
Now what year? What year?
15 years ago.
So let's see, it's 2019, so 2004.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, because, he basically, he was like, you should come out also, because he had some friends who lived here. They were gonna be out of town, so he had their apartment for the weekend. He's like, yo, you have a couch to sleep on. He was like, you will love New York. And he kept telling me, he was like, you of all people, Jamal, need to be in New York. He knew I was, at the time, I hadn't made a single dime on music. I felt like I was good enough to make a living as an artist in some capacity, you know? Being just honest with myself, I think at some point you just feel like you've crossed that threshold, if you will, where you're like, no, I'm a professional at this now. And I felt like I had crossed that threshold, but I wasn't seeing the results, if you will. So
you weren't seeing the money.
Exactly. So I happened to have a buddy pass, a Southwest buddy pass. A buddy pass, right. So a friend of mine worked at Southwest Airlines and they would buddy passes where you could basically fly standby.
For free?
Yeah. Well, I they would get them for free. I bought it from him. I think I paid $100 for it.
So, and this is like $100 for free airfare for?
Correct.
How long?
It's good pretty much forever.
Just $100 and then you get free flights for life?
No, for one flight. So you get, the buddy pass allows you to basically fly standby on a round trip flight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so you got here and you hadn't really made a lot of money in the music industry, and then you...
Right. So I came here to visit. Like I said, he had the couch open for me. Okay. So I came out here on the buddy pass since I had it already, and I was like, all right, I'll come out. And as soon as I touched down in Manhattan, I knew immediately. I was like, yeah, I have to live here. The first bar I went out to in Brooklyn, I was sitting there alone, and two guys were sitting there talking about, hey, have you heard, I don't remember the name, let's just call him John. Hey, have you heard from John? And the guys were like, oh no, he's been working for Atlantic Records recently or something. I was like, man, see, I need to be here. You know, the first conversation that I hear at a bar is two people talking about someone working in the industry. And I was just like, yeah, it was one of those moments.
Yeah.
And here I am. And I've been here ever since, 15 years now.
So let's talk about your hustles in New York. So
sure.
You started, you had bartending experience before you came here?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things about New York, the restaurant industry is, as I understand it, I have, actually have worked in the New York restaurant industry, but when, as I understand it, they sort of like haze you and they're like, oh, you don't have New York experience, we're not hiring you.
Totally.
You have to have, just because you have bartending experience, it's not New York experience. Next.
Totally. That is definitely a thing. And it took me longer to find a job than it had ever taken me in my life.
So you probably had to be a bar back in Bay Ridge or something.
Not quite, but I did almost though. But I did have to take a bartending / waiting tables job at a newer restaurant that basically didn't have any bar clientele. So they knew that they couldn't get a super experienced person in there at the time. Even though I had a ton of experience, I didn't have the New York experience.
Now here you go.
Right.
Quickly getting New York experience.
Right.
So nobody can pull that on you ever again.
Exactly. Exactly. So once you get it, which now that I've been here, I understand what that is. I used to think, oh man, these New York bar owners are assholes. What the fuck does that mean? Is that okay to curse on it?
You can say whatever.
Like, what is this, you know, New York experience bullshit? But now that I've been here for 15 years, I understand it. Because what happens is people, they get amazed by this city. They come here. They see the Statue of Liberty. They see the, you know, Empire State Building. And they're like, I want to live here. And then they get here and it's hard. You know, it's expensive. It stinks in the summertime. You get
smells
sweaty.
Good, right? Smells good right
smells
here.
Amazing
we
right
are
now.
Sweating.
Absolutely. So it's a lot more work than people think. The glaze, the glamour is worn off, and only the people who are real hustlers who really want to do something in this city stay here, as far as the people who move here. Now, the people who grow up here, that's a whole different story. They've kind of fallen into their zone. But in my experience, a lot of people pack up and leave after 6 months, you know, because they can't handle that first 6 months. It really takes, I think, a good year or two to get comfortable in this city.
Yeah, but I think it takes a lifetime.
I could agree with that, too.
I think it takes a lifetime.
I agree.
To be able to afford a place where you want to live.
Right.
And to figure out what it is you love to do and how do you actually make money. Just because you love it doesn't mean you're going to make money at it.
Totally.
So totally. Mm-hmm. 15 years in New York, mm-hmm. bartender, mm-hmm. You do camera work, you picked that up.
Yes, I did. I picked up the camera work really to supplement my music. It really started when I started touring with the band.
So you started...
I'm going to leave the band on. You know what? I'll name the band. So what? I was touring with a group called Shanghai Restoration Project. And that's how I pretty much got to see quite a bit of the world as a musician. And
they're a Chinese band.
Well, the producer, Dave Liang, is a Chinese American.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, he was born and raised in the States. And he's the producer of the project. But we had a large following in Asia as well as the United States.
Yeah.
So we got to go around Asia quite a bit as well. I basically, on our first trip abroad, we didn't tour, but we did a show in Tokyo. So I enjoyed Tokyo so much that I was looking for a project with a story attached to it. So I did a music project called 7-Day Visa, which basically was inspired by Tokyo. So the first one was called Tokyo.
These are songs.
Well, it was actually an entire album.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I did the album Tokyo, and I felt like I, since it was based on the city, I needed some kind of visual component to go along with it. So at the time, this was right around the time where HD cameras were very expensive. You were talking $5,000 to $10,000 for any kind of HD camera. You could find something that was shooting 480, but that wasn't really good
480.
Enough. 480! Right, exactly. Yeah.
This video is being shot in 1080 just because I don't want to pay the extra storage fees for 4K.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Nobody's complained to me about 4K just yet. About not having 4K just yet.
But 1080p up res to 4K pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you could do that, but they still, there's these people on YouTube that, you're no 4K, I'm not watching the channel.
Ah, forget those people. We're talking about, where was I?
Japan started, you wanted visuals.
Oh, I needed visuals. So, I started doing
480, I got right. hooked on 480.
So the best I could do was 480, so I was like, well, that's not gonna do it. I need something that looks professional, polished. So what I did was I came up with the idea that I was going to do time-lapse videos for the city because a still photo is 10 times higher resolution.
So you took a bunch of still frames.
So I
with a digital or old-school camera?
Yeah, I bought a Canon PowerShot. I don't remember which one it was, but the reason I bought it was it had an unlimited buffer for JPEGs, so it could shoot continuously, unlimited.
So at very high quality.
At very high quality,
much
exactly.
higher quality than a 480 camera.
Exactly. I believe it was like 8 megapixels, but that's 8K.
Right.
Right. So it was fantastic, right? Which an 8 megapixel camera now is pretty much poo-poo.
So you shoot this amazing looking visual. Now, back then, does YouTube exist? Like, were you able to put it out on the internet?
Yeah, YouTube absolutely existed.
Did it get some hits?
Not very much.
But you know, I direct music videos.
Yep.
And you know, it's not always easy to just because you shoot an amazing project, you pour thousands of dollars into it, doesn't mean that it's actually gonna go somewhere.
It totally doesn't. But what it did do, it was still a complete success in this regard. I got work from it. So all of a sudden, this guy, Rob Morant, wanted to hire me to do his music video. And I had never shot a music video, but in my mind, I knew how. You know, I have that creative mind where if there's something I'm into, I'll go down that road to try to figure out how it's done. Even if I haven't done it yet, I might think, oh, you know what? I'm gonna do this one day. So I'll go down the YouTube rabbit hole or whatever kind of literature or interesting facts and information I can find on certain topics. Video production was one of them that I happened to go well down that rabbit hole. So I got hired by this guy, Rob Moran, who's an R&B singer, to produce a music video for him. That video actually ended up airing on VH1 a few times. So I feel like the Tokyo videos, even though I think the one to this day, the highest view on that is maybe 2,500 views, and it's been out for over 10 years. But like I said, the video I shot for him called No, that ended up getting 100,000 views, I believe, and airing on VH1. So, you know, these things are relative. You never know what's going to stick. And
so here you are, New York City, and you have a mix of hustles.
Totally.
You've got barman. You know, good money, good dependable money coming in from the bar.
Mm-hmm.
You've got another new side hustle, which is visuals.
Yep.
And then you still have your audio production skills.
Yeah.
So right about now, how did this hot sauce idea come to you?
Wow, believe it or not, that is such a long, it's not a long story, but let me see if I can back it back a little. Through all of the traveling I got to do as a musician and some as a shooter too, I got paid to go to a few places as a DP or as a photographer. One of the things I always really enjoyed doing was going around and photographing the markets, okay? In basically every country I've ever been to, there's always some amazing market that the locals go to where you get some amazing food with that one person who has one item and they just do it so well that they're famous in that city, maybe even in that country for making.
So right? Let's talk some countries. Like
yeah.
What could they make a list, name some names.
Oh, I think where I've been? Let me see. Okay. I can name them all. I'll go with, I've been obviously our neighbors. I've been to Canada. I've been to Mexico.
So you got any hot sauce inspiration in Canada?
No hot sauce inspiration in Canada.
I wouldn't think so.
Although I am, at some point, I will be incorporating some maple into a sauce.
Now that's interesting.
So yes, there's absolutely some Canadian influence.
Good save right there. Excellent spin. So, yeah.
So Canada, Mexico, definitely some hot sauce influence with Mexico, but not so much sauce. Let me continue before I go back to the sauce.
Sure.
Mexico, definitely an inspiration with the street food. There was an item down there in Mexico called a marcasita, which is this dessert that's, it's like a waffle cone, but elongated in a cylindrical fashion with cheese and caramel inside. So you have salty cheese and sweet caramel in this sweet waffle cone. One of the most delicious things I've ever eaten.
So mixing sweet and savory in the same thing.
One of the most delicious things I've ever eaten. And that was one of the other items that just made my brain go, that would be amazing at Smorgasbord in Brooklyn.
Right, and for those of you who don't know, that is, we actually literally passed by the location that Smorgasbord is. And it's sort of this food-centric flea market. So normally, you might have a flea market with like clothing items, and there might be a food stand set up there, or a bunch of food stands. So here in New York City, where space is at a premium, and this is really a gastronomic city, there's literally just a flea market full of new and upcoming businesses.
Yeah.
One of them, for example, I saw Mighty Quinn's come up at Smorgasbord, starting as a little booth.
Right.
And now they have 100 locations all around the globe. So you said Smorgasbord. I wanted to let people know,
right,
you know, that it's this market. So, and then you were sort of just painting your travels.
Right. So Mexico, Canada, I've been to Argentina, Colombia, France, Spain, Ethiopia, India, Nigeria, Japan, Indonesia, Malaysia, China, mainland, and Hong Kong, Thailand, Cambodia.
So England. You go to all these places, and you're getting a lot of flavors. A
lot of flavors.
A lot of perspective and, you know, different, seeing the way that people live in different countries, realizing maybe how lucky we are to live in America, how freaking safe it is here.
Totally. Totally.
You're getting this tapestry.
Yes.
You're getting this this sort of all these experiences.
And there's a consistent thread throughout them. And it's this entrepreneurial spirit, which kind of speaks to your program. And it's something that I was noticing. I was like, wow, these people who are running these businesses everywhere I've gone, these outdoor businesses, they are all super happy. And I know part of that is customer service. And that's part of your job, and part of that is just the nature of customer service. But I feel like I saw a little more in that. I saw real freedom in the sense that when you work for yourself, you are in charge, which I know it is, it's obvious that that's what that means, but there's a certain epiphany that happened for me when I really understood what that meant, and you see how that benefits people. And as someone who grew up with a family who had a small business, I know how much work it is. So I didn't have any disillusions about it being, oh, really easy. No, it's as hard as you can ever work. Working for yourself is the hardest thing you're ever gonna do. But all these people I knew who were doing it were so happy. So I was like, you know what, there's gotta be something to this, right? And then being outdoors in the open air, I think part of me was craving that a little bit, because New York, you're inside a lot, you know? It's, you get that cabin fever in the wintertime. The summers are hot, so a lot of times you're in and out of AC buildings, or there's just not a lot of green space in New York for what it is, you know? It's a concrete jungle.
Sure.
It's amazing, but just not as much green space. I don't live close to Central Park or Prospect Park, so. Through these travels, seeing all these outdoor businesses and stuff, my wheel started to turn for several years. I was like, you know, one of these days, I think I want to do something like that.
Well, one of the things about, you know, entrepreneurship is typically this idea sort of sticks in your head. And you might like you might have the initial inspiration, and then for like 15 minutes, you're sort of like, oh, I'm going to change my life. This is the idea. And then maybe, you know, you wake up the next morning and the intensity is not there.
Exactly.
But for those things where you're waking up and you're still thinking about this same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it just doesn't leave you.
Right.
That's sort of when you know you have an itch that needs to be scratched.
Totally. And New York has this vibrant outdoor vendor scene, whether it's Smorgasbord that we spoke of or just the weekly street fair.
Been to it?
Yeah, no, I have not been selected for Smorgasbord.
Okay.
Yes.
So,
but I haven't tried either.
Well, that's got to change, right?
I've had people say that they're going to get me in. It has not happened
well,
yet,
but
I haven't tried.
But, well, that needs to change.
Well, you know, there's a double edge for me because I have a hot sauce company. I move around every weekend, so I'm in different neighborhoods. Smorgasbord is in one location. So as famous as it is, there are also other famous locations in New York. So, for example, if they do an event on 8th Avenue in Manhattan, you're going to get just as much or more traffic than you're getting at Smorgasbord.
Okay.
And half of those people aren't from New York, which is good for my business because half of my business model is shipping. So those people try my sauce, they buy it here, they can't get it in their home state or their home country, and guess what? They have to go to my website and buy it. Smorgasbord makes you commit to the entire or a quarter of the season.
Oh, you have to, so you
yes.
can't just drop in for one show.
No, and that's, so it's a double edge. I could see it working, and I'm not saying I won't ever do it. If it comes my way, it's something I will definitely strongly consider.
How you like them apples?
PSP Brooklyn.
So let's get back to, so you're seeing this this outdoor scene,
yeah.
right? This vibrant outdoor scene.
Absolutely.
And like, how did the idea for PSP come to you? Like for, like, where is it like, I'm gonna take a hot sauce and I'm not a cook. I'm not coming from, you know, a deep professional restaurant.
Right.
You know, at least, yes, in the bar scene, but not, that's different from being in the
yeah,
kitchen.
Yeah, totally different. And no, you're right. I'm not a chef. I've always prided myself on being a halfway decent cook, but you know, we're talking about in the context of home cooking and the hot sauce business. I didn't start as a hot sauce company. Pepper, salt, paprika are three of the main components when you're cooking Southern food. So one of the things I noticed going around New York is the Southern food in New York is not the greatest. Now, of course, there's some good food here and there's some good Southern food, but the majority of Southern food that you find in New York, in my opinion, is going to be subpar. My family's from the South, so I grew up being the benefit of really good Southern cooking. So
where did your family?
My mom's from Texas, my dad's from Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then
love
I've got
it.
Family spread out all the way across the South.
Love it.
Yeah, so I grew up with, you know, with really authentic Southern flavors. And in my experience, you can find them in New York, but they're rare. You know, for example, catfish is actually really difficult to get as a restaurant, to get good quality catfish in New York. And I know this because when I started researching a business, I started looking into catfish. So when I started my business, I started a Southern food business. Well, backing up a little bit, I started getting the idea that I wanted to do some kind of food out there because I saw there was a lack of Southern food. And I was like, you know what? I make really good catfish. My catfish po' boys would kill at Smorgasbord. This
right.
was literally, this was my thought. And I had this thought for several years. It's like, it would kill at Smorgasbord, you know, because no one was doing it. It's not a super expensive item to make. There's a demand for it. I just thought it would do well. So I started going down that rabbit hole a little more, started doing research. And my sister, who is also an entrepreneur.
What does she do?
She started as an apparel line, but now she has her own cosmetic company.
Now we're talking.
Called Color of Beauty.
So maybe she'll be on the show.
Maybe so. Well, she's in California.
But
when you go global, which you will.
This show already is global. I've already done episodes outside of New York.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. She's fantastic. She was an entrepreneur before me. she was the one who actually helped me streamline my e-commerce portion of the business by moving me over to Shopify instead of a GoDaddy, just because their e-commerce portion of the website development is ten times better.
I get it.
Yeah.
So, but I still want to get like to the inception.
Oh, okay.
You know, you start trying to do the Southern food business.
Right. So I started going down the rabbit hole of the Southern food. All of a sudden, I meet Dave and Stella Fedoroff. They're a husband and wife team. They came into my bar, which is The Drift in Greenpoint.
So literally right here.
Yeah. So they came in and we got to talking, and come to find out they own Fedoroff's Roasted Pork, which is one of the most famous roasted pork sandwich shops that sells the Philly style roasted pork sandwich as well as Philly cheesesteaks. They got their start at Smorgasbord.
Yeah.
So I got to talking to them just because, you know, doing the bartender thing, talking to them, and come to find out, I start talking about potentially doing an outdoor food business, and they're like, hey, that's how we got our start. You should do it. So they started giving me the serious push. At this point, they're still doing Smorgasbord, but they've already opened up a brick and mortar. They're super successful, right? So this was kind of like that final push that I needed, you know, was just to meet those people that were actually doing and confirming everything I thought it was going to be, if that makes sense, right? So everything I thought doing this outdoor business was, they were doing it and confirming that, yes, you are right. There is that much money available out there. Yes, it, everyone out there is making a profit if they're doing it right, et cetera. So at that point, that was the confidence that I needed.
So what'd you do?
So I took basically the credit cards that I had, and that I still have, thankfully, and I maxed them out buying fryers, buying all the restaurant equipment I needed for outdoors, tents, and everything. And then I ran out of money. And I was looking at getting a small loan, and my father lent me $2,500, which I just paid him back 2 weeks ago, actually. I've been
in business
for 1 year.
Congratulations.
I tried to pay him earlier, but he was like, don't worry about it. But a couple weeks ago, I made him take it. I was like, no, I'm paying you back. I've never paid you back any money you've ever given me, and it was important for me to pay him
back. Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those things. It just felt good to pay your dad back for once.
Sure. Right?
Yeah. So he lent me the final $2,500 I needed to get the business started, and I went out, right? I did a bunch of tasting. Well, before I went out, I got a couple friends. At that point, once I had the money in place and the equipment, I started doing tastings. I had a couple friends come over, specifically one of my friends who's an executive chef.
For a sandwich?
Yes, to sample the food that I was planning on doing. So I ultimately settled on fried okra, fried catfish, a fried okra po' boy, and a fried catfish po' boy. So I had something for the vegetarians and for the non-vegetarians. I had them come over and try my food items. And for me, in order, I don't believe if you're a food business, I believe that you have to make everything from scratch. Of course, I wasn't going to bake my own bread, but a po' boy has remoulade, which is the equivalent, for those who don't know, that's like a spicy tartar sauce, very popular in Louisiana region, etc. And also hot sauce. I was like, I don't want to buy Frank's. I don't want my sandwich to taste like everyone else's sandwich.
Yes.
So I was like, I'm going to make my own hot sauce. Okay. I had never made hot sauce in my life.
Right.
But I'm one of those crazy people who believes you can do anything if you try. You know, I'm one of those strong people that believes, I don't believe in luck. I believe in preparation and effort, you know, and the one thing that you can control in life is your effort. So I went on a mission to make good hot sauce.
Now, did you get the hot sauce together for that executive chef?
Yes.
So, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did it take you to, like, once you decided I'm doing hot sauce, how long did it take you to make something that was good? Because it is good.
Thank you. Well, I started with green sauce because after doing research, cayenne's really difficult to get in New York fresh. It's almost impossible to get fresh cayenne
now,
in
fresh,
New York.
Do you mean not powdered?
Not powdered.
Now, are you giving away trade secrets by saying that?
No, not at all. Not at all. So I started with jalapenos.
Yeah.
Because getting fresh cayenne in New York was really difficult. So I started with jalapenos, because I could get jalapenos at my local grocery store. And I started experimenting with sauce using the jalapenos. And believe it or not, the first recipe I made out of the green sauce is almost exactly the same as the green sauce recipe I use now.
But you've probably gone through like hundreds of different combinations to realize that.
With the green sauce.
Yeah.
The green sauce, I literally, the first recipe was right. It was delicious and I couldn't believe it. It was almost like I struck gold. I was like, wait, I don't even know how this happened. So I put it together and it worked immediately.
So did you put that sauce on your po' boy and then serve it to everyone?
Not quite. So after that, I felt like I was confident enough to spend a little more money and buy cayenne. So cayenne, like I said, it's hard to get fresh cayenne, but what I realized in my research is like you could get whole dried cayenne. I didn't want to get powdered cayenne because I didn't want my sauce to be granular. I want it to be very silky. Right?
So, see that, guys? Silky.
Silky. I make a luxurious sauce.
The sauce is luxurious.
Yes.
I don't even think of it, you know, in those terms. It's fantastic to hear it that way, but it just tastes good. That's what you need to know.
Thank you. So I started ordering cayenne and different types of cayenne to try to come up ultimately with what ended up being my Carolina Red.
And that was the first sauce that I tried.
Right.
At the market. And I literally tried it. I'm like, I got to get this guy on my show. That, you know, that sauce right there is a winner. And now the question is, how do you take this sauce that not a lot of people know about on the grand scheme of things?
Yeah.
Compared to a Tabasco.
Right.
How do you take a sauce? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm going to ask that question later because I still want to hear the end of, you know, the beginnings of PSP.
Right. So I got about 10 different varieties of cayenne together, and I started playing with them to get the perfect.
Did you, what was the point where you're like, all right, maybe I'm not gonna do a po' boy frying fish business and started focusing more on hot sauce? Talk about that.
Okay, so when I did the tasting, when I finally came up with my sauces, et cetera, I brought my friends over, one of them being my executive chef friend, Al, and they tried the food, they loved it. But my friend Al pulled me to the side and he was like, hey man, the food's great. And he was a roommate of mine for a while too. So he knew my cooking. He's like, you're a really good cook. But man, that sauce, he kept saying, he's like, it's all about the sauce. He kept telling me that. It's about the sauce.
Did you ignore him?
I did not ignore him. I took his advice and what I did was I made the sauce a soft sell. So I had my red and my green sauce. And I bottled it with a generic label. I didn't even have names for them.
Okay.
It just had PSP, it had pepper, salt, paprika, and the ingredients on the bottle. That's it. I didn't even have a name for the sauces. But I had a red and green. They had the same label on them, right? And I made them a soft sell with my food. So I go into business, my first week of business, and the food does okay. My signage is terrible, so no one knows what I have. But we break it even for the day. The people who actually tried the food, they liked it. But something amazing happened. I sold out of sauce. I think I bottled 50 bottles that day. The second week, I did another event.
And here's what I want to know.
Yes.
Did people buy the sauce because they tried it on the food?
Okay, so that's interesting. There was no crossover. People either brought the food or the sauce, which is not what I thought was going to happen. It was counterintuitive to what my expectations were.
Because you thought people would taste the sauce on the food.
Correct.
And then want to buy it.
Correct. That is not what happened. People who wanted to try the food, they came and bought the food. People who saw the hot sauce came and wanted to try the hot sauce.
Yeah, so you sampled them. Mm-hmm. And once they were sampled, boom, it was game over.
Correct. So the second week I went out, same thing happened. I almost sold out of the 50 bottles that I brought with me. The third week, food was backbreaking, by the way. And I made a small profit the second week, but it was trending upwards. I definitely think the food was going to be successful. I don't at all consider it a failure, but it was taking a little longer to get where I needed to go, right? Because I was so new to it. I really didn't know what I was doing in hindsight, you know? But the third week I said, you know, I'm gonna take a little break and I'm gonna see what happens if I just sell sauce this week.
So what happened?
Because the weeks before, by the way, my overhead goes down $700 a day if I'm just doing sauce. The booth's cheaper, I don't have to pay a chef, I use a smaller vehicle, so everything gets cheaper. So I went out with just sauce.
Yeah.
And I sold 120 bottles.
So your best weekend ever.
Yeah.
So not only are you making more revenue,
oh, yeah,
but you are not spending so much.
Absolutely.
So that's really what you're looking for.
100%
in a business.
So
if you're spending a lot of money, mm-hmm, right, and you're making an amazing experience, but you are not making a profit, that is what we call
a hobby,
a work of art.
Hello. Exactly.
And there's a big difference between an art, mm-hmm, a hobby, and a business.
Absolutely.
So here you are, you, mm-hmm, sold 120 bottles.
Yeah.
And Did it even, like, when was the moment where you're like, I'm dropping food, I'm selling all my fryer equipment, I'm focusing on sauce?
Halfway through the day.
Literally on the day.
At about 3 o'clock. At about 3 o'clock that day, I was like, I'm a hot sauce business. I was having fun because, you know, I'm a bartender, so I'm good at talking to strangers. I don't have these hot fryers back here. It's just 10 times easier. I'm enjoying myself. I'm having fun. I'm talking about my two sauces. I may have had a beer or two back there behind my booth. Hey, it's New York City, right? It was just great. And I sold 120 bottles. And immediately I said, you know what? I am a hot sauce company. So it's kind of funny. I never jumped in this business. A lot of people jump in this business thinking, okay, I'm going to be the next great hot sauce company. Maybe they watched Hot Ones or something. They got inspired. That was not what it was for me. And I guess
Hot Ones is getting tagged.
Yeah, no kidding, right? They're good for my business, though, I tell you that. You know, it makes hot sauce very popular.
There's so many different styles of sauce on that show, though.
Totally.
You know, there's, mm-hmm, Asian-style sauce, Indian-style, yeah, sauce.
Uh-huh.
There's other sauces, styles I can't even think of right now. But I just want to get back to your story.
Sure.
Because we love getting sidetracked.
Yes.
So you make the decision in one single day to sell your restaurant equipment.
Yes.
And you're like, I'm a hot sauce company now. Yep. So what year are we talking? Talking a year ago?
This was last year.
Literally.
Yeah, I started the business. April 14th was my first day.
So you've been in business.
2018.
You've been in business for a year.
Yes.
And you're seeing money coming in.
Yes.
And you are going out to, you know, flea markets, mm-hmm, which is a really great, in New York City, it's a really great way to market yourself.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit bigger picture about how the business is going. And I think a great segue for that is you'd start developing this sauce. Mm-hmm. Actually, I want you to talk a little bit more just about the last year. So you talked to me about day three.
Okay. Like the past year of actually becoming a hot sauce company?
Yeah. Like, yeah, just, sure, tell me some stories about the growth of the company.
Sure. Once I decided ultimately that I am a hot sauce company and not a food brand, I started kind of trying to subtly rebrand myself, because the name of my company is Pepper Salt Paprika, which doesn't exactly scream hot sauce. People,
yeah,
think those are the ingredients to my sauce sometimes. So that is not what I wanted people to think. I didn't want people to think that, oh wait, they've got 5 different flavors and they all have pepper, salt, paprika in them. So I started rebranding myself as PSP Brooklyn, because I wouldn't have to change the pepper, salt, paprika portion of it, because I already had customers who recognized that, and I owned all the websites, the social media, etc., associated with those. So I bought the website PSP Brooklyn, and I already owned Pepper Salt Paprika. And basically, I'm still Pepper Salt Paprika, but I use the hashtag PSP Brooklyn. You can also go to
PSPBrooklyn.com. PSP rolls off the mouth easier.
Yes, exactly. And it allows me to push back the Pepper Salt Paprika into the background. It's still the name of the company, but it's not in the foreground.
All right, so you do.
So they don't think those are the ingredients.
So you do a rebrand.
Yes.
So that's on that aspect. Mm-hmm. And let's just talk about, like, you know, where you've been, how do you deal in the winter month? You know, let's talk about that.
All right, well, I've basically been all around New York selling at all of the street fairs, hand to hand on the street. And with that, what's your question?
No, go ahead.
With that comes the development of the e-commerce business. So the great thing about the New York street fairs is that half the people are tourists. So I mentioned this earlier, they come, they buy the sauce, they have to go back to their country, their state, And now they're in love with the sauce, so they want to get some more. They come to my website and they buy it.
And so let's talk mm-hmm. about how many of your orders are repeat orders. You know, they mm-hmm. sample it once, they buy one bottle.
Yeah.
And like, and I know you've only been around a year, so you don't yeah. have a lot of data. Very impressive for a first year of business. But talk about repeat orders.
The repeat business has been outstanding, which I don't know the percentage, but I know Shopify gives me a bunch of analytics all the time. I know that my close rate on my website is 7.85%, and the average in food products is, I want to say, 2-point-something%. So they put that on my headline every day on my analytics, saying that you are doing outstanding as far as your hit rate. So something is working with the branding or with the product where people are coming back and they're buying it.
It tastes good. That's what's working.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing at the end of the day. At the end of the day.
You can put all your analytics. You could put $100,000 worth of analytics on something. If it doesn't taste as good as yours, it really doesn't matter. That money is going to waste.
I think there's some truth to that because my site is not that fancy. You go to my site, it's very basic, it's very simple. It's clean, but it's very simple.
When I go to a barbecue restaurant, mm-hmm. if the restaurant is fancy,
mm-hmm.
I don't walk out. It's not that I walk out, I just don't like it. I like, because it means they've invested in trying to make it look fancy,
yeah.
and they're not focusing on the food.
Right.
You know, when I go into a barbecue spot, I want it to be bare bones, mm-hmm. and just, I want to smell it, you know?
Yeah. I think it's almost like you don't want the big board. You don't want an 8x2 plank that's meant to overdress up the barbecue. Honestly, I'd be happy. Give it to me in a styrofoam to go.
Yeah.
And we're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
As long as the food's good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
we're talking about repeat business as a percentage yeah. of your overall business.
Yeah, you know, with the online portion of it, that is still growing. I find that there are ebb and flows with that, especially during the holidays. Our holiday sales were outstanding.
Yes, they always are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't launch the online part of the business until October of last year. So it's only been in effect for less than a year, the online portion. So that is still in the works and growing rapidly. So I'm really happy with how that's growing, but I couldn't tell you the exact percentage. I know that I have a couple customers who have ordered 6 and 7 times from me, one of which I just recently sent him a free bottle. His name is Matt. I won't mention his last name, but he's a local New Yorker, and he's ordered from me about 7 times now.
There you go.
In a year.
So you're hustling in New York. Have you mm-hmm. thought about, maybe it doesn't make sense for you to go set up a booth at a major flea market in LA? Maybe it doesn't make sense yet. Maybe it's, you know, financially 2 years down the road,
yeah.
you know, before something like that. I would talk about that.
So currently I produce all the sauce myself.
Oh yeah, then we need to get into production.
Right. So every one of the bottles I've sold, I made them with my own hand. I'm at a crossroad right now where I am actually having to not participate in enough in certain events because I can't keep up with the production.
Right.
There's only so much production I can do as an individual.
And you feel you're making enough money to maybe justify
right.
Taking your capital and putting it towards labor as opposed to so that you can free up your time because you feel that affects your bottom line.
Correct. So I'm trying to decide upon one of two business models very actively right now. I'm trying to decide if I want to ultimately become a larger sauce producer and hire multiple employees and have a permanent kitchen that I'm making sauce out of, as opposed to renting a kitchen, paying a co-packer to produce, if anything, if not all of my sauces, 3 out of my 5 maybe.
I would tell you to go the co-packer route because, first of all, other food companies on this show have gone the co-packer route, and yeah. now this dude is doing shipping containers worth of product.
Mighty Quinn's?
No.
Oh.
This would be Ahini Vegan Tuna.
Oh, I saw that episode.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And fundamentally, I believe mm-hmm. it's a build versus buy decision.
Yep.
Your numbers are just not at the place where unless outside capital is coming in,
totally,
you want to buy equipment on your own.
Right.
And I'm talking about significant amounts of outside capital.
Oh, yeah, we're talking six figures.
Seven, and then eight, nine, ten. And then once you own that equipment, it really behooves you to make sure that equipment's running 24/7
exactly.
To make that investment back.
Right.
So you're really more in the co-packing business than
exactly.
you would be in the sauce business.
Right, okay, so you're speaking to my dilemma. There's a part of me that feels like I am leaning towards the co-packer model for two reasons. Partly what you mentioned, but also because I enjoy being the salesman. I enjoy getting out and talking to people. So the more time I'm making sauce or overseeing the making of sauce, the less time I get to be out there with the people, getting people to taste my sauce, trying it, and trying to get them to fall in love with it, right? So the co-packer model is definitely the one I'm leaning towards, but there's the part of me that has talked to other sauce producers. A friend of mine.
Okay, now this is interesting.
Owns the company called, what is it? They're called.
If you name them, they're going to come on the show.
Saucy Sauce. It's a Vietnamese dipping company. Man, if I got Ken's, his name is Ken Nguyen. I hope I didn't get the name of the sauce wrong. I believe it's called Saucy Sauce. It's a Vietnamese dipping company. And he started his company very similar to the way I did. He was doing outdoor events, etc. And he's now in Whole Foods and stuff.
Right, which is, when do you think you're gonna hit Whole Foods? Well, they need to know that you have operations.
Yeah.
That you can, when they make an order, you know, they'll test you out in a store. Then they'll test you out in two stores, then in four stores, then in eight stores.
Yep.
And ultimately, they're not just testing your flavor. They're testing your ability to execute and supply.
Yes.
So, and this is what separates somebody from being a flea market business from a real business.
Right. Well, here's what's interesting. When you go retail, okay, after talking to my friend Ken for a lot, we talk quite a bit about this. He's gone through several different co-packers. And one of the things he told me is like, you will go through several co-packers because you'll have to find the one that's right for you. And it's gonna be frustrating, according to him, which that makes sense. You know, there's gonna be some growing pains. You know, maybe one place doesn't do it quite the way you want, et cetera. But there's the other part where, yes, they are. It is a flea market business model that I have now, but it's a flea market business model in New York City.
Okay.
Which is different than any other city in the world, because these are not just flea markets. These are street fairs that they block 10 blocks off in the center of Manhattan every weekend. So you literally have hundreds of thousands of people who walk by these things. It's like having a billboard in Manhattan every weekend.
Well, that's what it is, because location, location, location.
Exactly. So I could never afford the brick and mortar
yet.
Well, at this point in time. So back to the Whole Foods thing. What happens when you go into retail is you have to start negotiating for shelf space, et cetera. So with retail, immediately I take in half the amount per bottle because I'm selling it wholesale, right? But also because I'm such a small company at this point, no one is looking for my brand.
Right.
So for me to get that eye level shelf space, I'm gonna have to either lower my price so low that my profit margin is gonna shrink so small that I'm barely in business unless I'm selling maybe four times the bottles that I'm selling now.
Yeah, you could do that. That's like nothing.
It is nothing, it's an interesting,
I just threw out that bomb there.
What's that?
I just threw out that bomb.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
But what I see your brand as having the potential with the flavors that you have.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you actually get there?
So you just spoke to my number. My goal right now is what I told myself was that I'm gonna sell 100,000 bottles hand to hand and on my website, and then the companies will come to me and ask for me to be in their stores.
Now what happens if they don't?
If they don't, then I will pursue them actively. And I have a track record. I have a recognizable brand. If I sell 100,000 bottles in New York, then I can sell 1 million around the world.
So here's what I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you're not a numbers guy. I'm not a numbers guy, but yet
I'm becoming one now that I own a hot sauce business.
Right.
Slowly.
Yes. Some part of me is asking, like, has your month on month been growing?
Yes.
Or Are you not tracking it, or?
Oh, I track it.
Is it growing fast enough?
Yes, but that's where the dilemma comes in, where I have to change my production.
Right.
I have to grow. I'm getting to the limits of my production. And I, basically with my model now, I want to get 100,000 bottles in within 3 years.
Yeah, so yeah. I think it's a very smart move to get help, you know?
Yeah. Help is on the way. I just don't know what it looks like yet.
Right.
Yeah.
But this is why I love it. Right. I got you at the right time.
Yes.
Because you're at that sweet spot of supply and demand. Mm-hmm. You're at that other sweet spot of needing to scale, being a solo. You are a solo operation.
Yes. Uh-huh. I have an accountant.
There you go.
My dad, who's a retired accountant, is my accountant.
That was an interesting way of putting it.
Right. Exactly. I brought my dad out of retirement to be my accountant. How about that?
I love it. When do you think you're going to go after Whole Foods?
As soon as I make the decision with the co-packing. I actually have a couple local co-packers that I'm in communication with now about them potentially producing my sauces for me. I'm also in the process of looking at larger kitchens. The kitchen I use now is very small. I use them for a friend's restaurant.
I'm glad you're in a professional facility.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I've actually had my, what they call your food study done by Cornell University and stuff. Even though my labeling is as an artisanal brand, I have all of the paperwork in place to go full-fledged into stores anytime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're just waiting for the right moment.
Exactly. Exactly. My plan, remember, I didn't start as a hot sauce business. So I literally... It started making money before I even knew what I was doing. So it's been this really weird thing where all of a sudden I've got this business that's taking over all of my finances. It's becoming my main source of income, and I don't even know what I'm doing yet, right? I only had two sauces, and all of a sudden...
Now you have four.
Now I have five.
Ooh, wait, what's the fifth? I don't even think you had five when I was at your booth.
I might have been out of one that day. These are in order spice level. I have my everything green. That's a jalapeno sauce. I've got my Indonesian cayenne, which is obviously a cayenne sauce, but it's a little sweeter, a little
influenced
peppery.
Influenced by your trip to Indonesia.
Yeah, and the variety of cayenne I use is actually an Indonesian variety. I went through several varieties of cayenne before I settled on that one, because it's like if a cayenne and a Szechuan had a baby.
Oh.
So you get that classic cayenne flavor. I add a little more ginger to that with a nice Szechuan-like tingle on the back end.
Ah.
Yeah, so it's got a lot of layers of
depth. I want to drink that right now.
Delicious. I've got some in my bag. We'll get you some. And it's not as hot as the Carolina, so you'll probably survive. Don't let it go up your nose this time. So then I've got my sweet Thai chili, which basically, my travels to Asia, I took the flavors of Southeast Asia and I converted them into a Louisiana style hot sauce. Okay, and
so we're talking real fusion right here. We're talking Southern Asian fusion.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
We're talking.
Yes.
Fusion.
Well, because at the end of the day, once I decided I am a hot sauce company, I said, well, I don't know anything about hot sauce. I know how to make two sauces. Well, I was like, well, what can I bring to the hot sauce game, if you will, that other people may not be able to bring? And one thing I do have under my belt that a lot of people don't have is I've been to a lot of different places. I've sampled a lot of different cuisine. And I've also learned to look at things like anything creative as a balance of frequencies. So whether I'm making music, whether I'm doing photography, or whether I'm making sauce, whether you're dealing with sounds, colors, or flavors, they're all frequencies. So when you balance those frequencies, then you have something that is viable that other people will be able to appreciate.
That's why your sauce tastes so good, because you have this interesting theoretical framework, and definitely a creative mind, which is a great, like, that's what you need to do what you're doing.
Yeah. What's funny is I think everyone is creative. I think a lot of people just aren't patient enough with their creativity.
Go talk on that. That's interesting.
Everyone has good ideas. There's not a single person that you've met that has not had a good idea, that has not had a creative vision of some sort. But in my experience, personally, and through meeting other people who've had this experience, most people are afraid of taking that chance. They're afraid of judgment. They're afraid of failure, which, of course, failure is scary until you take on the mentality that failure is just another lesson. It's just another experience. It's another way of adding something to my tool shed. And when you take on that mentality, that's when you can be successful. That's the one thing I believe that I have that I wish other people could take from me. And if they don't try my sauce, then no, take that mentality
from
me.
You're trying the sauce. Let me get the bottle. There you go.
You're trying the sauce. But also, you know, try out that mindset. Try out the mindset of there is no failure. There are only lessons and experiences. And once you do that, I think your creativity is unleashed, you know, and it's unlocked and uninhibited. And that's kind of where I've been going with my flavors recently with the sauce.
I love it. You got a real chief culinary creative officer right here. I think we've got a good overview, but I think we've got a good picture now as to your journey.
Yeah.
So in wrapping it up.
Sure.
And I know we started to get into this territory, but the one question I ask everybody who comes on this show is, in what ways do you think you have grown as an entrepreneur over this process or over your life? You can answer however you want.
I've grown in my discipline. I've become a much more disciplined person. Coming from the art world, I've always been disciplined in the sense of, if you give me a call time, I am there 15 minutes early. I always have been, because it always annoyed me when artists were late for sound checks and stuff like that.
Right here. Right here, diva.
Got a diva
right here.
One of those guys.
Sorry.
Yeah. So I never wanted to be that guy, but you know, crunching numbers, being a product business, it was never something I saw myself doing. This is the hardest I've ever worked in my life, but it's the most satisfying thing I've ever done. With that, with trying to grow this business, at the same time as it being a major part of my income, has really forced me to become a lot more disciplined and to really just trim the fat in my life. Like, you know what? These things are not that important anymore. Certain aesthetic things, it's not important for me to go have drinks with the friends as often. It's not that I don't love my boys, love my friends, but you know what? I got sauce to make. I've got numbers to crunch. And I found that these things are making me more happy than anything. So I'd say discipline and just that excitement of actually doing business, something I never thought I'd ever have.
Fantastic. So guys, we heard the journey of Jamal Richardson and Pepper Salt Paprika. Codename PSP Brooklyn. So you put that in, perfect. Go to PSPBrooklyn.com.
Yeah, go to PSPBrooklyn.com. Follow us on Instagram, please.
This is going out on Instagram, so you're gonna be tagged.
Yeah.
So
if you can't order it online, come see us at one of the street fairs. I'm out every weekend. I post on Instagram where I'm at. Absolutely. So you can order online or you can come buy it in person. You know, whatever works for you.
I love it. I want to tell you to go order this. I have given it my seal of approval. So this is good stuff and you should try it. So thank you so much for coming on, Jamal.
Hey, thanks for having me, Hunter. It was a pleasure, man. I really enjoyed it.
Yes.
Thank you, brother.